transparent interface with federal customers and industry partners. He leads the integration of HON affiliated sites.
This is DJ Johnson, VP of Honeywell.
Good morning. Okay, now this is the full crowd. Come on, you got to do better than that. Good morning. Thank you. See, I know you've been fully caffeinated, so you're ready for this morning. And so happy Valentine's Day to everyone. Let me just say, we don't take it for granted, your attendance here today. There's a lot of places that you could have been, but the fact that you are dedicated to this mission, to this industry, to the nuclear deterrence mission and our nation's security is evidenced by your presence here today. So we don't want to take that for granted, so thank you. I also want to echo as well our thanks to the Exchange Monitor, to all of the sponsors who have helped to support this 15th Nuclear Deterrence Summit. And so I just want you to just not only give yourselves a hand, but give a hand to the Exchange Monitor for putting together this summit. So thank you. Now, I know that you're all here to see me as the moderator, and I appreciate that. I dressed for the occasion. But really, it's exciting to have our guest speaker today, because I did the math. She's actually been in her position for 18 months and 19 days. Now, for you geeks out there, that equates to 890,917 minutes that she has been in her position. Not that I'm counting, but it's incredible what has happened in the 18 months and the 19 days that she has been in position. And so we're very fortunate, very privileged, and honored to have the Undersecretary for Nuclear Security for the Department of Energy and the Administrator of the National Nuclear Security Administration. A very warm welcome to Jill Ruby.
Well, I have to say I didn't count. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be back for the 15th Annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, representing the Department of Energy and the National Nuclear Security Administration. Thanks to the summit organizers for the invitation, and thanks to all of you. We seriously appreciate your interest in our mission. I want to touch on a few areas today, and then I'll take some questions from DJ and the audience. First, I want to start by talking about the international environment and how it's impacting our work and mission priorities. Second, I'll go into some of NNSA's near-term priorities, along with some of the challenges we are facing as an organization in executing our mission and delivering for the American people. And finally, I'll speak to some recent updates, accomplishments, and coming attractions. When I addressed the summit last year, it was February 7th. Just 3 weeks later, Russia launched an unprovoked full-scale invasion of Ukraine. This reprehensible action has significantly impacted our activities in NNSA. In the broadest view, Russia's invasion has raised questions about the elimination of nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees, as well as the safety and security of nuclear power plants, especially those acquired from Russia. This has damaged the global nonproliferation regime as states seek to either retain or acquire their own nuclear arsenals, and it has stressed the International Atomic Energy Agency's peaceful nuclear uses mandate. To offset the conclusion that acquiring nuclear weapons is necessary for national security, we will enhance our efforts to assure our allies that our security guarantees are ironclad. and our nuclear arsenal is safe and effective. Additionally, we will expand our nuclear security assistance to look to partner on everything from science and technology to emergency response capabilities. In nuclear zones, Russia has operated with a reckless disregard for nuclear safety during the invasion. Its actions in Chernobyl and Zaporizhia, whether restricting the movement of workers or active shelling in nuclear zones, are violating safety standards. To be blunt, nuclear power plants are designed to handle incidents of all kinds, but war is not one of them. This weaponization of energy is deeply concerning. From the start of Russia's invasion, NNSA personnel have supported interagency and foreign partners to monitor radiation levels and provide technical expertise, data collection, analysis, and training. We are also facing other developments from peer and regional competitors. China continues to advance an aggressive nuclear modernization program, with a December report suggesting their arsenal contains about 400 weapons today and might contain 1,500 nuclear weapons by 2035. North Korea is actively testing missiles to improve and diversify its delivery capabilities and has stated its desire to be the world's strongest nuclear weapons state. Finally, Iran continues to enrich uranium to higher levels and at a faster pace. In the interest of global stability, the United States has also made national commitments that involve NNSA capabilities. Most prominently, we continue to work with our interagency partners on the AUKUS trilateral partnership with the United Kingdom and Australia to provide Australia with a nuclear-powered, conventionally armed submarine capability. The initial 18-month consultation period for this partnership is set to conclude this spring, and we look forward to taking the next steps in helping a key ally improve both its security and the security and stability of the Indo-Pacific region while maintaining the highest non-proliferation standards. We've also seen a surge in interest in the adoption of nuclear technology as a means of providing reliable zero-carbon electricity to combat climate change and to promote other developmental goals. NNSA remains committed to facilitating the peaceful adoption of nuclear energy technology while acknowledging that a large civil nuclear community will require additional resources to secure critical sites and sources, expand anti-smuggling and counter-proliferation capacities with partner nations, and promote the highest safeguards and security standards as outlined by the IAEA. In some of my recent speeches, I've pointed out the American people are hearing more about nuclear issues than at any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis or the collapse of the Soviet Union. In both the military and civilian world, nuclear is in the middle of a renaissance. Meeting this moment, and I believe we have the determination to meet it, will require us to be proactive and adaptable to rapidly changing circumstances, not our strong suit. But thank you for being part of this renaissance. With all that in mind, NNSA has important work to do. Our mission needs are pressing, and there are important activities in our mission set. We will require focus and creativity, and that's why last year we released NNSA's integrated strategic priorities for FY 2023, aligned with the strategic vision released in 2022. So let me share some of our priorities. First and foremost, we will remain fully committed to providing a safe, secure, reliable, and militarily effective nuclear deterrent to increase schedule margin. In the more uncertain geopolitical environment, our nuclear deterrent remains the cornerstone of our national defense and provides critical assurance to our allies in Europe and the Indo-Pacific. To deliver weapons, we need to modernize our infrastructure. The rapidly changing nature of the challenges we face requires an enterprise capable of responding to these challenges in a timely manner. The nuclear security enterprise of the future we envision is resilient and flexible. And we can't forget the capabilities and infrastructure we need to advance our scientific capabilities that allow us to verify the safety and security of the stockpile and introduce new technology into our weapons without resuming explosive testing. This simultaneous modernization of our existing capabilities while revitalizing our science and manufacturing base has challenges. After the Cold War, the nuclear security enterprise shifted focus. We went from producing thousands of plutonium pits and their associated components for our arsenal with tens of thousands of weapons to providing maintenance and stewardship for a smaller, tailored arsenal. It made sense to do this during a time of strong international cooperation on disarmament, relative geopolitical stability, and a weapons stockpile that was within its design lifetime. The current international climate and the growing age of our weapons stockpile make this approach unsustainable. Additionally, many of our production capabilities have atrophied, become obsolete, or outright disappeared over the last 30 years. Reconstituting those lost capabilities while providing the flexibility and resilience I mentioned earlier requires the successful completion of multiple large-scale construction projects and many smaller-scale infrastructure projects that can both handle our immediate mission requirements and provide stability over the long term. In the next 10 years or so, NNSA intends to complete 2 new construction projects for pit manufacturing. In addition to that, we will be completing the uranium processing facility at Y-12 and continue work on other projects for secondary production, such as lithium processing. We have also started work to expand the Kansas City National Security Complex for non-nuclear production. We are investing in new and updated scientific capabilities, including exascale computing, pit aging and qualification facilities, high-density physics, radiation effects, and office buildings. Beyond these projects, we must modernize and secure our supply chain for high explosives, expand capacity at Pantex, and lay the groundwork for having an unobligated enriched uranium supply for tritium production and naval reactor fuel. Given the workload, we need to move to new delivery models for our projects. In the past, we built our infrastructure out to the maximum extent, and when the Cold War ended, we were left with large and aged buildings, environmental contamination, and the challenge of restarting production from scratch for critical items like plutonium pits. Going forward, we need to be creative in facility design and cultivate capabilities that can rapidly scale up or down depending on the international environment and mission need while being minimally disruptive to contracts, workforce, facilities, and the environment. Of course, this rebuilding has not been without its challenges. Somewhat famously, I would say, the environment for large-scale construction has been difficult the last several years. After COVID, we still have labor shortages, declining productivity, supply chain issues, and inflation that drive the cost of construction up. Most notably, we are seeing an acute shortage of specialized craft and trade workers who are certified to work on our critical nuclear projects. While this has resulted in schedule slippage and cost increases for our ongoing infrastructure projects, we are working closely with our Department of Defense colleagues to make sure the U.S. stockpile always remains effective. I also want to make sure to touch a little bit on nonproliferation, counterterrorism, counterproliferation, and emergency response. These programs continue to serve as critical complementary parts of our deterrence policy and national security, and their importance has been highlighted since the invasion of Ukraine. The relationships built with allies over decades, coupled with the readiness of response and sophisticated capabilities, enabled NNSA to put in place additional radiation and other sensors, and to work with Ukraine and the surrounding countries to raise awareness of all nuclear issues. The intra and interagency efforts on Ukraine have been impressive. Everything from a supply of backup parts to emergency training to medical provisioning. I am immensely proud of what our team is doing as part of the behind-the-scenes effort in Ukraine. An area of nonproliferation that is garnering increased attention from us is the growth of interest in nuclear power because of the climate change fight and to meet the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. We will focus on working with companies developing advanced reactors to help put safeguards and security at a level equal to safety in their designs. We will also work with newcomer countries on their ability to track, transport, and manage nuclear and radioactive materials safely and securely. Our focus in this area will be on engaging partners, allies, third-party countries, and international organizations in capacity-building exercises, equipment transfers, and promoting international safeguards. Along with these priorities, we are evaluating a strategy for disposition of 34 metric tons of surplus plutonium that is achievable and aligned with other NNSA objectives. And we are establishing a revitalized arms control program to make sure any treaty we agree to with any country has credible technical verification approaches. None of these priorities can be successful without a strong workforce. Our labs, plants, and sites, and federal staff have experienced a higher attrition rate than normal in 2022, about 10%. We worked aggressively to fight the attrition trend, including a mid-year salary adjustment across the non-federal NNSA complex, more flexible benefits, and a competitive salary increase for calendar year 23. We are beginning to see improved retention. However, we still worry about demographics. As an example, about 16% of NNSA's federal employees are eligible to retire now, a number that is expected to grow to around 36% by mid-decade. The departure of experienced senior staff, some of whom have held multiple positions across the enterprise, means a loss of institutional memory, technical skills, and leadership ability. Last year, the Nuclear Security Enterprise hired over 11,000 people with a net growth of about 4,000. I also want to touch briefly on our management and operating contracts and how we are aiming to evolve those consistent with our mission demands. About 95% of NNSA's dedicated workforce work under the M&O contract model. This model has served us well over the last several decades, but with our mission growth, the workload at our labs, plants, and sites is expanding, and going forward, we have to bolster long-term relationships, improve flexibility, and accelerate mission performance through our contracts. I asked two of our experienced federal leaders, Jay Tilden and Steve Ho, to conduct a study on enhancing our ability to deliver mission. The intent was not to have another outside evaluation of our enterprise, but to have an inside look at how to improve ourselves. The resultant report, released in September of 2022, now commonly referred to as EMDI, Enhancing Mission Delivery Initiative, recommended actions that will help us improve the health of our federal and M&O relationships and productivity. We are taking implementation of these recommendations very seriously, and we are involving the whole of the enterprise in the implementation. Some of these recommendations have been initially implemented, and we will continue to find ways to further improve. Others we are planning to implement, and finally, a few will require further investigation and stakeholder engagement. There is nothing more fundamental to our ability to innovate, collaborate, and deliver than getting the M&O model right, and I intend to stay focused on that effort. Finally, and very importantly, we will continue to strengthen our constructive partnerships with Congress, our partners in the U.S. government from the Department of Energy, Defense, State, and Homeland Security, and international organizations like the IAEA. Consistent bipartisan and interagency cooperation is vital to the success of our mission. Before I wrap up, I'd like to just touch on a few updates and accomplishments from around the enterprise. As I previously noted, we are actively modernizing our existing nuclear arsenal. To accomplish this task, we are executing 5 modernization and life extension programs for different systems. Last year, we reached first production unit for both the W88 ALT-370 sea launched warhead and the B-61 gravity bomb. And both programs are now in full-scale production and on track to meet Department of Defense schedules. We are continuing to advance our efforts on the W80-4 cruise missile for the Air Force and remain on track to meet operating schedules. The W87-1 mod for the Sentinel ICBM has successfully moved to the development engineering phase, and the W93 remains in early design. It is worth noting that the W93 continues our strong partnership with the United Kingdom. Outside of modernization, we have made significant strides in our stockpile stewardship program. Last year, we recognized the 30th anniversary of DIVIDER, the last explosives nuclear weapons test conducted by the United States. In the decades since, we have relied on a science-based program to ensure the safety and reliability of the nuclear weapons stockpile, including subcritical experiments and advanced computing simulation and modeling based on decades of study and data collected from past nuclear tests. It's hard to overstate the success of this program. Not only have we been able to refrain from explosive testing for 3 decades, but in many ways, we know more about nuclear weapons now than we did when we were actively testing. And the best part, we expect these capabilities to continue to improve. First, our computer modeling capabilities will be getting a big upgrade in the near future. El Capitan, the first exascale computer designed for national security, is expected to arrive at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory this year. At over 2 exaflops, it will, for a time, be the world's largest supercomputer. And in addition, there was some exciting news about Ignition this year. And my remarks last year, I pointed to the major accomplishment from Lawrence Livermore's National Ignition Facility, where an experiment yielded more than 1.3 megajoules of energy and resulted in burning plasma state for the first time in a fusion research facility, inching closer and closer to the threshold of ignition. Well, this year, I come back to say, we did it. In early December, scientists at NIF capitalized on more than 60 years of global research, development, engineering, and experimentation by using the world's largest and most energetic laser system to achieve a net energy gain. This major scientific breakthrough has opened up a new chapter in stockpile stewardship, enabling us to study new regimes. Unlocking ignition at NIF will allow us to probe the extreme conditions found at the center of nuclear explosions and address significant long-standing stewardship questions. It also shows the brilliance and grit of our scientists, engineers, and personnel from around the enterprise. NNSA also had significant accomplishments in the nonproliferation area. We finalized 10 years of collaboration between the United States and Kazakhstan by converting the 3rd nuclear research reactor from highly enriched uranium to low enriched uranium. We reached similar results with our partners in Japan, completing the final transfer of 45 kilograms of high enriched uranium from Kyoto University to the United States for permanent disposition. Since 1996, we have disposed of enough material to produce about 325 nuclear weapons. The disposition work would be impossible without our labs, plants, and sites, and has made a critical contribution to global nonproliferation and global security. And we advance our governance. In addition to EMDI discussed earlier, we are moving forward with contract competitions. Late last month, NNSA released an RFI to seek ideas, comments, and insights from industry on topics such as contract length, proposal scoring, key personnel parameters, and more. This is the first RFI released by NNSA's relatively new Partnership and Acquisition Services organization, and the first RFI since EMDI was released. We want your input, and I think we got it yesterday, and on this and the associated RFP. It's important that we have contract competitions that bring new ideas to the table and increase our site's productivity and stability. Okay, that's a lot to cover in a short amount of time, however many minutes, I'm sure DJ is counting. The main takeaway is that our challenges are significant but not insurmountable. We have the skills and determination to succeed and are committed to working with our partners in Congress, the U.S. government, and internationally to coordinate the resources, expertise, and willpower to meet this moment and to promote America's security and global security. Thank you. I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Jill. So as you kind of settle in, have some water. That was a lot to get through. And so I'm going to have to coach this audience because there were several things in your opening remarks that you should have just been bursting out in applause. But because, I mean, think about this. She talked about full rate production for the B-61 and the W-88. And oh, by the way, we were recovering from the height of the pandemic. During that time, that should be an applause line for this entire enterprise of what you in this room have been a part of. And so you should applaud right now for that. To spend 60 years working on nuclear fusion and to have ignition done at Lawrence Livermore, that's exciting. And again, another applause line for you. I want to start off the discussion with Jill, and we've got about 33 minutes. We will take some questions from the audience, but since I am the moderator, I get to kind of decide how I want to do that. But I have several questions I'd like to ask her and follow up with her on. Because in my opinion, Jill, I think one of the greatest deterrent capabilities we have within our enterprise is our workforce. I really believe that. I think without the workforce, the highly trained, capable workforce that we have, and you touched on that just a bit in your comments, but retaining that workforce, training that workforce is critical for the next generation that we're headed into. So I'm wondering if you would comment a little bit about what can we do and what this audience can do to attract people to this enterprise, to not only recruit them, to retain them.
Right. Well, thanks, DJ, and I couldn't agree more. Without our workforce, we had no deterrent. And we've, you know, put a special emphasis on that already, and we will continue to. So I just, first and foremost, the thing that attracts and retains people is the mission. And we can't do anything better than talk about our mission to the workforce. And it's a little bit hard when they first come, but it is a real retention ability that we have is to show people how their work matters and to talk to them about that all the time. Because when you're working your day-to-day, you don't always realize like how this matters to the big picture. So it's incumbent on us and all of us as leaders and to talk to our workforce about that. That's the biggest thing we have. But we do have to make sure we're competitive, and it is a tough time to be competitive. There is, you know, a shortage of good people at all levels, and we've tried to address that. And the first time in history we did this mid-year salary adjustment for our M&O contractors, and I talk to people, I run into people, you know, staff members at our labs, plants, and sites who tell me about the raise they got and how it mattered to them. And I've had people at all levels, including, you know, people in our technologists and administrative assistants who tell me it made the difference to how they put food on their table, right? And we had to also compete, you know, with high-tech companies. So that was a big deal. And it ended up, you know, never been done before. We could do it. It turns out we could do it, and we could do it fast. I was like, if we can't do it fast, it's not going to help. So we did it fast. And that was important. And we also are trying to stay competitive on all of our benefits packages, which we've put a lot of pressure on. So we're going through this transition, and this is really what EMDI was about. It's what our organizational change has been about. We're going through this transition where we didn't have enough money to accomplish what we needed to do. So we put pressure on every cost to try to make the dollar go farther. But now we have money and it's hard to execute the work. And we have to make that transition, you know, and it's got to be in our mind and in our hearts how we make that transition. And it'll be good for everybody. It was overdue. But so, you know, we've got to talk to our workforce about mission. We got to do it every day, again and again. And we have to be competitive. And I think we're on the path for both of those things, but we won't be able to take our eye off of it. But yeah, without our workforce, we have a lot of expensive facilities. That's what we have, but we don't have a deterrent.
Excellent. And so there's a lesson for everyone here. We have to celebrate more. And again, that's why I'm trying to coach you about how to take credit for the things that the enterprise has done. And I don't want it to be lost that the mid-year raise that was given to the employees was done in a matter of weeks, not months, not years. It was when we talk about innovating and accelerating and delivering, that's an example of integrating, accelerating, and delivering. So again, another applause line. So let's talk a little bit about the supply chain challenges that you mentioned in your remarks. And a question that we got anonymously talks about the supply chain and asking about what things can we do from an acceleration and innovation perspective as it comes to procurements. So when you think about the supply chain and the vendors that we have, are there more things that we can do contractually to make it easier to do business with the NNSA? Things like escalation clauses to have to deal with things like inflation or changing the in terms of how do we get people cleared through the process? Are there things that you're thinking about, especially through the EMDI process?
Yeah, it's a good question. The main focus in procurement and EMDI so far has been on raising the levels for approvals. So that we can get things through the system faster and not have to get so many levels of approval, costs are higher. Of course, Kansas City has done a great job on supply chain, but in the construction projects, you know, one day it's pipe hangers, the next day it's electrical, the next day, you know, it's sheetrock. I mean, it's just, you just can't see it coming. It's so interesting. But in general, this is an area where we really have to build up our federal workforce, and we have to work with our MNOs closely to understand what things in procurement are the big levers, right? We have to start with the big levers. We tend to know the last thing that really bugged us, but we have to look at the big levers. And the first big lever is the level. And then we'll look at other things we can do. But it is a real issue for us. And so we invite your input on that.
Yeah, and there will be further discussion later during the summit as we have other officials who will come over and talk about some of the increasing procurement threshold levels. And then, of course, if there are good ideas that are out there in terms of how can we change particular contract clauses, all of those things will be welcome. One of the comments that Jill talked about, the RFI that just came out recently for the Pantex procurement, they are very serious about wanting our good ideas and good inputs. And so I very much appreciate the fact that your team is willing to listen to those great ideas. A couple of other questions that came in, and we can't have a conversation without talking about the plutonium pit production. those are always going to be on topic because it is such a critical need for our country and restarting that capability. So can you give us any updates as it relates to, for South Carolina, let's talk about pit production there in terms of where do we see as the number of pits per year that we think we can get to and when do we think we can get to those?
Yeah, I would agree. It's been almost an hour probably since I talked about pit production. So it's look, I mean, it's a big deal. In all seriousness, we've got to be able to do this. And it's unfortunate the headwinds we have in production because in construction, because I want to send the message we can do it, but we're working against, you know, some pretty strong headwinds in terms of what it's like to do nuclear production. But that being said, the plan has been, as you know, a minimum of 30 pits per year at Los Alamos and a minimum of 50 pits per year at Savannah River. We anticipate that due to all the different things going on that we actually will have years that we can already see where we'll need more than 80, right? So the minimum piece of this is actually true. It is, in fact, a minimum. So, it would be great if we could increase without adding shifts, but probably we won't be able to. So we'll probably be running multiple shifts. My belief, and the Enterprise knows this pretty well, is that the increase over minimum should be at Savannah River. And because we really do need Los Alamos to make 30 pits per year, but also to do plutonium science and process development. And so it's, you know, the way I think about this is 30 pits per year at Los Alamos and 50 or more at Savannah River. We will be able to increase the capacity. You know, the design accommodates that, but we'll be stretching it from the day we open it, right? And I shared with a few people yesterday that actually some folks in the room are involved in this microchip facility being built near Columbus. And they're building that building with empty space on purpose, because they know the technology will change before they open the building. Well, that's the kind of thing we need to understand and think about doing in our complex. You know, we're gonna study that and see what they're up to. And again, you know, we need the ideas of how to get flexibility in the system in a way that we can justify, that's affordable.
So let me kind of leverage on that discussion about infrastructure, because if we look at the federal budgets, we look at the priorities that you've established under your integrated strategic priorities. Pit production is one of those modernization capabilities, but there's this balance between pit production and the other infrastructure modernization things that have to be done in Enterprise. Tell us how you think about the balance of those. And maybe there's a synchronization that we have to do differently in that regard.
Yeah, this is a good question, and it's so bear with me. This is actually pretty complicated. So first, let me just start by saying, you know, we did this reorganization that created an organization that focused entirely on infrastructure, big right. projects and small projects, and all the creativity and the thinking that we can do in a more fluid manner between those, which is not the way we were organized before. It also created an organization that's completely focused on partnerships and acquisition, which is also super important to get the job done. So that we're still standing those up, right? But I'm hopeful, and I already see signs of how that's helpful. Now, on the construction side, we have this dichotomy going on where we have these pilot programs for non-nuclear construction that are going super well. They're coming, I mean, this is great. They're coming in, you know, under budget, faster than we anticipated. They're very nice designs. They're smaller, right? But they're working really well. And then we have these large nuclear construction projects that are at the opposite end of the success spectrum. And it's not for lack of everybody trying, but we're just experiencing it's labor shortages and productivity. It's supply chain, it's inflation. All these things are conspiring against us. But we're making progress. It's not as though they're just sitting there. In fact, there at UPF, there are 3,000 construction workers every day, right? I mean, these are big projects and they're happening. It's just we're running into problems. And and we're not alone. I think this is a place where you probably don't want to lead the pack, but in a lot of ways we're leading the pack on these projects, and that means we have to lead the solutions, right? There was a recent op-ed in the New York Times by Ezra Klein about the construction across the United States, referencing a paper that was done by folks at the University of Chicago that is called the sad and state of construction in the United States, right? This construction industry productivity is low. And you can track it and study it over a long period of time. And so we've got to figure out how to do it anyway. Just like we had to figure out how to get the B6112 in production during COVID.
Yeah,
right?
And there's probably newer technologies in terms of building and construction that have not quite yet been adapted within the country. I mean, that same article I read, and if you think about it from just a commercial real estate perspective, the same techniques that we've been using to build buildings, although world class, is not taking the next step technology-wise in terms of building. And so what things can we learn from an enterprise perspective of how can we build and be more productive and more capable going forward?
Yeah, we have to. And then we have to, I mean, unfortunately, you know, you don't just get cost increases and schedule slips for free. We are having to move out other projects in time. And in part, we've got to get some successes under our belt. We can't just keep asking for more and more money and more and more time without getting successes. And building two large projects at one site, for example, seem like a really bad idea to me right now, since we can't get enough people for one project. So we're taking a whole look at the schedule and the priorities, and we'll have to spend some money doing other things to make sure we maintain capability while we delay some projects, but we've got to get some successes in nuclear construction. We've got to get completion. We've got to get things people can see. We're going to have to show the way. Who knew that the nuclear industry was going to have to show the way? But we have to show the way through these large construction projects.
So many of the questions that I've been getting on the tablet all keep focusing on pit production, which I appreciate those questions. But I actually want to pivot a little bit differently and talk more about counterproliferation and things that we are either doing with our allies, things that we hope to do with them. And so can you expound a little bit more about some of the counterproliferation activities that we're doing and again, things that this audience can continue to focus on?
Yeah, great. I'm going to talk about non-proliferation, counter-proliferation, all that stuff is a bit of a bucket here. So we have in the past, with our colleagues at the Department of State, invited our allies to come to our labs to see how much we're actually doing, to get a sense of the science that we have, and to increase their confidence that we're serious about our guarantees. And we're starting to do that again. We haven't done it for a while. And they've been in some of our labs. We'll get them as far around the complex as we're able to within the security constraints that we have. And I'd like to see us start projects that are actually science and technology projects where we interact regularly. We have interacted on material minimization and other things, but interact across the spectrum more, so we're working on that. And we're getting, there's an increased demand from our allies to work with them on things nuclear, especially those in Europe. And we'll do that. We have to find the bandwidth to do that. It will involve our complex, of course. But now's the time. We're not doing a lot of interactions with our adversaries. In fact, I've been sanctioned, you know, so most of us, Frank Rose has been saying, you know, most of us in the NNSA leadership have been sanctioned by the Russians, so I don't think we're going to be doing anything with them. So that gives us some bandwidth that we, you know, before that we have to put to good use, and the good use will be with our allies and expanded collaborations.
So we've got about 14 minutes left. I do want to try to take a couple of questions from the audience. So as you're starting to think about your questions, we've got some microphones that are going to be going around. But I do have one last question that I want to give to you, Jill, and I want to talk about integrated deterrence. So out of the most recent nuclear posture review, we got a new term, and I'm not quite sure what it means. And hopefully you might know better than what I know, but can you talk a little bit about integrated deterrence?
Yeah, I love this question. Look, we have actually been talking about integrated deterrence, but to believe that there is a common sense of what this, I mean, there just isn't a common sense. I participated in a nuclear pod. We said the right things about it, but we didn't put all of the actions around it. So I think this is really important. So let's just pause again and think about this moment in time. If we have two peer adversaries, and that's what we anticipate coming, right? So we've got a peer adversary already exists, Russia, China, not yet a peer adversary in terms of numbers of nuclear weapons, but they seem to be going there. So if you want stability by having the same number of weapons as your peer adversary, it doesn't work when you have more than one. It just starts an arms cycle, right? It starts arms racing. So we have to do something else. And the best idea for something else is to have other things, conventional weapons with increased capabilities, cyber, space, whatever the set of other deterrent things are to complement nuclear weapons so that you don't get into a cycle of just building war, which you, by the way, never closes, right? So that's, to me, that's why integrated deterrence is so important to our enterprise, is in the world that we see coming in the not too distant future, we can no longer expect that we're going to have we're going to have the same number as China and the same number of Russia, but we can't have the same number of them combined, otherwise everything just, right? So it's a simple need that we think can be met by technologies other than nuclear, but that needs to be explored, and that's what integrated deterrence, that's the promise of integrated deterrence. But we still have a lot of work to do because, I mean, frankly, the DoD isn't organized for integrated deterrence, right? They're organized for expertise in a certain area. So it's going to be hard.
Yeah, and I can see why your theme of innovate, collaborate, accelerate, and deliver is so critical to the integrated deterrence, because getting inside the decision cycle of these two potential peer adversaries is going to be critical to how we can design, modernize faster than our adversaries can. And so I think that's a great point to bring up about integrated deterrence. So we have a question right here to the right, so go right ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Dan Leone. I'm the editor of the Exchange Monitor. Thank you so much for being here, Administrator Ruby. And how has it been 18 months already? Like Colonel Johnson, I'm not counting or anything, but looking ahead to the next 20 months and 22 days, I was wondering, the Pantex RFI, I think closed yesterday.
It did.
What's the notional schedule for getting, let's say, a draft solicitation on the street, not for Pantex, but for Y-12 coming after?
Yeah, the notional schedule is Y-12 is 1 year behind Pantex, right? So, but we are taking a close look at all the schedules, and I mean, honestly, trying to accelerate, the time that we take, for example, for reviews and things like that. We've got a lot of contracts lined up in a row here, but notionally, we're going to try to do these things 1 year apart.
I was wondering also, not to say anything against the good souls who are running them now, but the new offices, PAS and ESH and 90?
Yeah, 90, correct.
When's there going to be any permanent leadership there? Not again, thanks to all those who are out, just wondering.
Yeah, well, there is permanent leadership in ESH. Ahmad Al-Duke has that position, and in PAS, Pete Roderick has that position, and those are permanent positions. We still have the deputy positions to fill in those jobs, and NA 90, I guess not surprisingly, has been a bit more difficult, is in terms of, you know, getting people qualified for that large set of activities. But we are actively interviewing for that position, and you know, hope to be able to fill it relatively soon. It's super on my mind, Dan, and all of you. I mean, we're working on it, and we're kind of 2/3 done, maybe a little bit more than that.
Thank you. Another question to the room.
Hi, Stephen Young with the Union Student Scientists. Thank you for being here. Appreciate your time and input. One question for you on PIT lifetime. Congress has asked you to do a 10-year plan for looking at PIT lifetime, but I haven't seen that out. Is there a time when we'll have the 10-year available, when we have results from that plan?
Yeah, thanks for the question. The answer to the question is, in all honesty, I'm not sure. And I don't know. I know Marv's in the audience, if he knows the date.
And Marv's going to actually be speaking to the group probably in one of the other sessions, so I'm not sure if we want to hold that until Dr. Adams is able to answer.
He says hold it.
He's
calling a friend right now. But here's what I can say about PIT lifetimes. We continue to pay attention to that for sure. And we've worked with Livermore and Los Alamos, have worked together and have created a common narrative around PIT lifetimes that's very good. And you know, that's, it's, you know, we have peer labs for a reason, but there's been differences of opinions, and I think that's a good thing. But we have now a common narrative around this, and you know, we are building facilities at Nevada that will help us study this, study more detail about it and around the complex. But we're not, we're still on the path that we've been on, that we feel like we have to have PIT production as a capability, because guaranteeing 30 or 40 more years of life for some of the PITs is really, you know, quite hard to do that far in advance, and we're not able, ready to do that yet, but we're still working on PIT production, and Mark's going to be prepared to talk all about it later, I think. But thanks for the question.
Okay. One more?
Thank you. Yeah, we'll take one more, and I don't know what's wrong with this side of the room. Why are all the questions coming from over there? But we'll talk about that later. Let's take this question right here.
Yes, good morning, Jill. Thanks for being here. Greg Mello, Los Alamos Study Group. Can you elaborate a little bit more on the schedule that you anticipate for PIT production for war reserve PITs at Los Alamos National Laboratory If you can attach any confidence levels to those years, that'd be good. So how do you see this unfolding?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. Well, you know, this is another place where our schedule has slipped. We are doing this, we've just started the construction phase of a project we're now calling 30 Base. There's another construction project called 30 Reliable, just so that for people to kind of understand that technology. So we'll have the equipment needed to produce 30 a year. We might not have 100% acceptance on those 30, and that's where the 30 Reliable comes in. So, and that construction project the schedule for that is to be complete in 2030. We will, of course, be, you know, doing process development before then, and we're doing our level best to pull that back because of our needs. But and that's all, Mark and others can talk about it in more detail if you want, Greg, or offline. But we're, you know, that information's pretty, just within the last, you know, few weeks, we've been resetting that baseline and getting 30 base approved.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for the questions from the audience. I want to give you 2 minutes to kind of wrap this up towards the end, but before you do that, first of all, I want to tell you how incredibly thankful we are that you spent the time with us today. Your remarks were very important to this summit. I hope all of you enjoy the remainder of this summit. This was a great start as a keynote address to have Jill with us today. And so, Jill, how about any closing comments before we say goodbye?
Well, thank you. First, let me just go back to sincerely thanking all of you for your interest in this mission. It's niche-y. There's not a lot of people that are dedicated to this, but boy, is it important. And I think we're, you know, recognizing how important it is. Occasionally other people notice, but mostly we just know how important it is. And we've got big changes to make. You know, I'm going to talk to the Strategic Posture Commission this afternoon, and I'm fully anticipating the question being, why can't you go faster? And we have to go faster, right? And all the things that we're doing, and we are doing a lot. Reorganizations take a lot of time, but most importantly, it's about getting our heads around our priorities. We're not doing a reorg to do a reorg. We're doing a reorg because there's real priorities, and we have to have dedicated people looking at various things, the EMDI initiative, all of the things we're doing for workforce, but mostly all the stuff the complex is doing every day to make sure that, you know, we have the facilities we need, that we're doing, that they are responsive, that they're responsible, that they're safe, they're secure, they're environmentally friendly. It's a lot to do, and we need all of you, and we sincerely, I know we don't always act like it, but we really sincerely appreciate your interest and dedication to the mission, because it's going to take all of us. So thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you.